You know, that's another thing. It's not a random guy writing poems and another random guy writing poems. There's an intention to form a kind of school, you know, to, and not like, oh, you go to the school to study, but a unified group. I hope you were paid sufficiently.
Hi, welcome to Literary Italy. Follow us on Facebook at Literary Italy, on Instagram at Literary Italy Podcast, on Twitter at Literary Italy. Our email address is mail@literaryitaly.com. We'd love to hear from you there. And our website address is www.literaryitaly.com. Hi, Anne.
Hi, Jim.
How are you?
I'm fine. Are you finished tweaking your knobs? Welcome, everyone. I think this is going to be an interesting episode. It's already interesting. We are still talking about Sicily.
Yes.
And after a while, I'm sure everyone's going to be like, why? They're still talking about Sicily. This is a really important one, though. This is the one we should have started way back when, May, or whenever we started this whole Literary Italy thing. We're going to be talking today about the Sicilian School.
Yeah.
Which is really the origins of Italian literature. That's what we're talking. I mean, we will specifically be speaking about one author, one poet, Giacomo de Lentini, but more generally, even this idea with the Sicilian school, this idea of having kind of making a literary Italian, making a language to write fine literature. You know, so this is not the language that you'd be using for your receipts or for your treatises or for your laws, but a language that you're writing specifically for, in this case, poetry with the Sicilian school. That's what they're known for. So we need to go back 800 years in our time machine. that's our very expensive sound effects. I'm really glad that was
money
worth,
well spent.
Right? All 10 cents. And so now we're back.
In the 800 years. 800 hey, all these people are wearing strange clothes.
All right. So, and we're back, and we're in Sicily with Frederick II.
Yep.
Frederick Hohenstaufen.
We have to say that our merriment here, in addition to being the result of Prosecco, has also been a lot of stress on our part trying to figure out how we were going to deal with Frederick II, because he's such a larger-than-life figure.
Right. So his nickname is the Stupor Mundi, the wonder of the world. And so we're trying to compact into these, whatever, half hour that we do these episodes, a whole lot of information. And I really want to focus it more on the literature than the history. But I think that we need to provide a little bit of history just for context. So hit it, Jim. All right. Frederick, born. Now, come on. Born 1194. Who's his daddy?
Is he rich? His father was the king of a German king.
Hohenstaufen.
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 His mother was Constance of Sicily.
Yeah.
And she was Norman.
Norman. Her name was Constance, right. Not Norman.
She was of Norman.
Yes.
Of Norman descent.
So that's the interesting. That's one of the interesting. I mean, he really is a stupor mundi. I mean, he really is a fascinating.
His father was Henry VI.
He's perhaps the most fascinating figure, at least of European history for the 13th century.
Yep.
I think that's not an exaggeration. So one of his goals is to unify these two huge kingdoms, Germany and this kingdom of Sicily, which is not just the island.
And be careful when we say Germany, because, again, the same thing we've talked about with Italy, Germany doesn't exist, right? So he's unifying a bunch of German kingdoms that are the Holy Roman Empire. unifying those with a Norman, someone of a royal, the royal house of from France, and establishing a claim to become king of the Holy Roman Empire, king of the Romans, as opposed, or emperor of the Romans. A lot of times you'll see a distinction in the histories between the Roman emperor and the emperor of the Romans. So he's trying to establish, or he becomes enmeshed in establishing kind of a large empire's, empire, I think, is a difficult word, right? Because they're a set of sovereignties that come to him. He eventually becomes king of Jerusalem, right? After the Sixth Crusade. So,
do you think he wants to be king of the popes?
I will not be king. I will be king of the popes.
Obscure reference. Yeah.
Second City TV.
Yes. He's Well, that is actually one of the issues. His run ins with the Pope,
right?
Because so initially, his father dies when he's only about 2 years old, and his mother moves with him back to Sicily, and he's educated in Palermo. His mother dies also when he's young, and he's under the protection of the Pope. I think it's Innocent III, and so initially, you know, you would. It seems like there's good support there, but with this mission, this intention of unifying this huge kingdom, this, as Jim was saying, this empire, he ran into some problems with the Pope.
Yep.
Because of this, his trying to establish this secular kingdom, and that ran afoul of the Pope that was establishing a religious kingdom. I don't know, what do you want to call it, on earth. But I think actually that this aspect of the you know, Germanic father, the Norman mother, born in Le Marche, being raised and educated in Palermo. And Palermo, I mean, we talked a little bit about Sicily, how Sicily is a crossroads. I mean, just take a look at a map and look at where that island is and how it's right smack dab in the middle of the Mediterranean. So there's Arab influence, there's Greek influence, there's the Normans. Here we have the Germans, we have, who am I forgetting?
North Africa.
Yes, the Phoenicians. It's like everyone's there and everyone kind of leaves their stamp. And I think what's interesting with Frederick II is that he embraces this universality. He's a very outward-looking monarch. He's very much looking out and open to, maybe we'll say, multiculturalism. I mean, that's what Sicily is. It's a very multicultural, multi-ethnic area. And not just Sicily, but a lot of southern Italy in general. But so what does he do? He has this court, which is not actually one central place. So yes, he's got a castle in Palermo. He's got a castle
in Puglia.
Yes, I mean, probably the most famous one is the one in Puglia, the Castel del Monte, which we did not go to see when we were in Puglia, and I regret that. But we just didn't have time. But I started making a list of his castles, and I stopped because there were so many. Because basically what happened is he conquered lands, he would seize the territory of these feudal lords and build onto these castles. And so they were partly military bases. I mean, so that means, as you could probably guess, they're in strategic locations, very high up on a hill or down at a port. But more than just military locations and kind of strategic locations, these castles were also the seat of a kind of cultural, kind of sort of Renaissance. I don't think Renaissance is really the right word for it, but a kind of, because I don't think it's a rebirth. I think it's a birth, you know, of an attempt to take what they've been seeing from the Provençal poets. So these are the troubadour poets, and from Northern French poetry, and some also German poetry in German, and come up with a native, you know, a Sicilian, a written Sicilian language for poetry. So with the Sicilian school, what their poems, all of their poems, for the most part, are about love, are love poems. But what's interesting is that the poets themselves, I mean, poet is not their day job. I mean, they're almost all court, you know, the courtiers or bureaucrats of the court. And but they all write. I mean, even this idea that you are not, you know, like Petrarch, you know, where Petrarch just wants to be the court poet and not do anything else. They're really seeing poetry as something that you incorporate into your life, but it is not your day job. So I thought for today, I mean, so to try to focus this a little bit, because this is a huge topic. One of the tricky things with the Sicilian school and these poets is we have almost nothing original in the original
Sicilian.
The original Sicilian that they wrote in. Because what happened is, so Frederick II was Holy Roman Emperor from 1220 to 1250. He died in 1250. So that's what happened. And when he died, there was nobody there to really take over, kind of continue his mission. And in 1266, I think it is, the Ghibellines, and so back up. The Ghibellines are the term used for the supporters of the emperor. The Guelphs is the term used for the supporters of the Pope. So Guelph and Ghibelline are terms that you may remember from our Dante episode. At least I think we talked about the Guelphs and the Ghibellines. Because, so in general, you might say the supporters are kind of divided between supporting the Pope or supporting the idea of an emperor. And with the fall of the death of Frederick II and the defeat of the Ghibellines, 1266 in Benevento, there's kind of a decline of that region, of that whole southern region, and as far as the cultural production. Instead, there is at the same time a rise in these large towns in central Italy, Florence, Siena, Lucca, Pisa. And what happens is that these poems that were written by the Sicilian school are effectively, I guess, translated. I mean, reinterpreted is almost, I mean, how would you say? I guess translated. Mm-hmm. And it becomes kind of a Sicilian Tuscan dialect that they end up writing in. And it makes some changes. You know, they definitely make some changes because those two dialects have different things like different vowel sounds. Tuscan has an open and a closed E sound, open and closed O sound. You know, so Tuscan actually has seven vowels. Sicilian has five. That makes it easier in Sicilian to do the rhymes are more
precise.
And other things like in Tuscan, you might the diphthongs are more common. So the word nuovo for new, that's N-U-O-V-O. In Sicilian would be novo, N-O-V-O. That also is easier to rhyme, that novo or nova, because it doesn't have as much of that vowel sound. But so the Tuscans kind of have their own way of reinterpreting reinterpreting these Sicilian models, the poetry from the Sicilian school, but then they go off and they run with it. And that's what we see when we get to poets like Cavalcanti and Dante later on. But I thought today we could perhaps talk a little bit about one of the most famous or the most highly regarded poet of the Sicilian school, Giacomo da Lentini, also Jacopo da Lentini, he's known as. His nickname is Il Notaro, which means the notary.
Yeah, I wanted to get my signature just validated.
He's a notary public. Yeah. Go see Giacomo. No, I mean, so he's a paper pusher. No, he's a poet. And he is considered the inventor of the sonnet. So there are forms from Provençal and that the Sicilians are taking, but Giacomo da Lentini invents, or kind of is an innovator, I guess, of this form of the 8 lines followed by 6 lines. So usually in stanzas of 4, 4, 3, and 3. I think that when we talked about Petrarch, I think I referred to him as the father of the sonnet. Giacomo da Lentini is also referred to as the father of the sonnet.
The sonnet has two daddies. But
they're separated by 200 years. What it really means is that Giacomo da Lentini really is the inventor of this form, or appears to have been. And certainly, I mean, Dante gives him special place in Purgatorio. You know, he recognizes him as the founder of this. And later on, Lorenzo de' Medici also considers Giacomo da Lentini as kind of the father. I mean, the innovator of this kind of writing. But what we get with Petrarch is a kind of perfecting of the form.
Yeah.
You know, so when we talk about the Petrarchan sonnet, yes, that Petrarchan sonnet is based on the sonnet invented by Giacomo da Lentini.
Well, he retains the 14-line structure that you outlined, but regularizes a different rhyme scheme, right? So so Petrarch has got that ABBA, ABB, right? Also has enormous... He's the person who is remembered for it. He enormously popularized it, right? So I assume someone like Shakespeare gets it from someone like Petrarch.
Yes, yeah. So... which poem? I thought we'll start with Sonnet 8.
That sounds wonderful.
Okay. I did a very quick, rough translation of my own. But I'll read first the original. So just to keep in mind, this original is not actually Giacomo da Lentini's original. This is a Tuscan adaptation of the Sicilian. So it's not really Tuscan, and it's not really Sicilian. It's something in between. It's a strange little monster. Io m'aggio posto un cuore a Dio servire, come io potessi gire in paradiso. A santo loco c'aggio audito dire, usi mantienzo lazzo, gioco e riso. Sanza mia donna non vivaria gire, quel che ha blonda testa e claro viso. Che senza lei non poteria gaudere, estando dalla mia donna diviso. Ma non lo dico a tale intendimento, perché io peccato ci volesse fare, se non veder lo suo bel portamento, e lo bel viso e il morbido sguardare, che lo mio teria in gran consolamento, veggendo la mia donna in ghiora stare.
Shall I read the Schuchman translation?
Yes.
Let's see what Schuchman
has to say about this.
I have fixed it in my heart to serve God so that I might go to heaven, to the holy place where I have heard it said, there is always solace, joy, and laughter. Without my lady, I do not wish to go, she with the blonde hair and luminous face, because without her I cannot have joy, being separated from my lady. But I do not say this with intention, because I want to sin with her, yet only to see her beautiful bearing and her lovely face and sweet gaze. For it would be my great consolation to see my lady in the glory of heaven.
Yeah, kind of a clunky translation it is. I kind of think luminous face is probably just blue eyes. That's my guess. Claro Viso. Mm. I mean, it's light visage.
But you,
they're always blonde.
But I thought I but luminous was the way when I saw the Italian that I wasn't looking at yours first. I thought that was a good translation.
Claro Viso. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what's the poet saying first of all before we break it down? He's saying, you know, my goal is to serve God and get to heaven. But I don't want to go there without my lady love.
Yeah, I think the thing that I really like about
you
this
know the is, blonde one.
What I really like about this is I feel like you could give this poem to someone when you know we always talk about that sort of sonnet form where you have the octave and then the turn for the sestet, and I think in these poems. This one and the other poem that you have, it's really clear that the focus in the octave is really on, you know, you have this focus on the heavenly and this sort of unexpected, but I'm not going to go there without my lady. And then there's that turn that it's not because I don't approve of the things of heaven, but because I see something heavenly within her and because she needs to be there for it to be heaven. I just see the form here is elemental. I don't know how to say it, but it's...
Well, he's saying, so in the first four lines, you know, I have fixed it in my heart to serve God so I can go to heaven because that's a great place. Mm-hmm. I'm going there. But then, oops, wait a minute. I can't go there without my lady love because she's blonde.
You
I'm really fixating on that just because it's such a trope. But then, But wait, now we have the turn. This is at the sextet at the end. But this isn't because I want to peccato ci vuole sevare. No, ma no. You know, it's not because I want to, you know, fool around with her. I am saying this that I don't want to go to heaven and be separated from her because I want her to be there too. Mm-hmm. This we start, I mean, I certainly think you can... To me, I read this and I start thinking, well, Dante read this poem, you know, for sure. This idea that this love is more than just the blonde hair and the blue eyes. This love is actually a love that his great consolation is to see her in heaven.
I'm doing everything I can not to do a very bad Lou Rawls impersonation. It's my lady love.
That's oh, all. Yeah. The lady love.
I don't have the deep enough voice to do my lady love.
Yeah, it could be. So that last line, vigendo la mia donna in giora stare. Giora would be gloria in standard Italian. So seeing my lady to be in glory, mm-hmm. being in glory. So a little bit of a twist. I mean, it's not simply like, oh, I love her eyes, her hair, her lips, or whatever. You know, it's, I have this conflict. I want to go to heaven, but I also love this lady. How can we sort of resolve this conflict? Well, if she gets to heaven too, then I could be with her for all time. Mm-hmm. I think that's the way I read it. Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah. Sonnet 26. Should I give the Italian mm-hmm. shot?
Sure.
All'aere claro ho visto pioggia dare e dall'oscuro rendere clarore e fuoco argente ghiaccia diventare e fredda neve rendere calore e dolce cose molte amarere e dell'amare rendere dolzore e due guerrieri in fina pace stare entra due amici nasceresci errori ed ho visto d'amore cosa più forte, che era ferito e san nomi ferendo. Lo fuoco donde ardea stutto con fuoco, la vita mi de fue la mia morte. Lo fuoco che mi stinse ora n'accendo, d'amor mi trasse e misemi in su loco.
I have seen it rain on sunny days and night aglow with light. And burning fire become like ice, and freezing snow feel warm. And many sweet things taste of bitterness, and what is bitter tastes sweet. and two warriors finally come to peace, and a quarrel arise between two friends. But I have seen an even greater thing of love, that healed me by wounding me. The fire that burned was quenched with fire. The life love gave me was my death. The fire that extinguished me now burns anew, drawn out of love, and put me in his place.
I thought you were going to do James Taylor with that first line. I've seen it rain on sunny days. I've seen fire and I've seen rain. Or I've seen rain on a sunny day.
Mm, yeah.
It's actually the Creedence.
This is just so like 1969, 1971. What I really like about this is that is all of the contraries and that those sharp contrasts that comes through. Those images are really sort of vivid, and then that sense that, you know, I've lived in this world of contraries, I've lived in this world of paradoxes, but the greatest paradox of all is love, that heals through wound, and it's about my experience of it. It's what it's done to me, you know, that it's healed me by wounding me. That the fire is, there's a fire that burns, that's quenched by fire, that love gives me a life that's death, that changes me utterly, that it's a fire that seems to go out and burns anew. I see that sort of sharp form. I mean, it really throws form into relief here.
Mm-hmm. Well, with the first eight lines, yes, being about these contrasts, you know, it rains on a sunny day, it's night.
But these are contrasts that don't really touch me, that I observe out in the world.
Right, and that's why he says, ed ho visto d'amore. I translate, even, it actually is, but I've seen of love, and I translate it as, and instead of end, I've seen of love, I translate it as but. So I emphasize that a little bit more in the English. So maybe it's clear, right.
You've said, but you know, an even greater thing of long, a stronger thing is something gripping.
Right. I've seen something even more amazing from love that healed me by wounding me, that burned me by quenching the fire that burned while quenching at the same time. Yeah, it's an interesting poem.
Yeah, what I hope that we get at from this episode is kind of what you've been going through is a kind of pointing to a kind of a route that's been forgotten, right?
Yeah. Well, and I will share these poems. I mean, they're a little bit tricky to find online. There actually is a fairly recent translation of Giacomo Dell'Antini. Maybe you can search for it while I talk about the castles.
Yeah, you talk about the castles. There's more.
I was going to say, so we talked a little bit about some of the castles. This is the part where we talk about places to go visit. So some of the castles of Frederick II. But you can also go to Lentini in Sicily, which is a small town between Siracusa and Catania in the southeastern part of Sicily. And it is a small town, and their claim to fame is Giacomo Dell'Antini, and also Riccardo Dell'Antini, who was an architect. I don't think they're related. I just think that it's like, oh, Giacomo from Lentini and Richard, who was from Lentini. And Riccardo Dell'Antini was one of the architects of many of these castles. So in Lentini, which the original name was Leontini, or sometimes, you know, the kind of the archaic form will be Leontini, and it's probably related to something with about lions, Leone, is, you know, I think as I was saying, it's one of the earliest Greek settlements in Sicily, and there's a castle there, which apparently Giacomo Dell'Antini controlled, you know, this castle. And some of these castles are, you know, some of the castles are really military fortifications. Some of them are actually like little towns, You know, so there are fortified towns. So you can go in if the walls are still in existence. You can go in and you can actually see where there were places where people lived and there were shops and there were things. There were basically these small towns. So the city of Lentini, there is an initiative to kind of preserve the memory of Giacomo de Lentini, Riccardo Lentini. And they have, I'll also share their link. They do... Some, you know, I don't know how often. I definitely don't think they're doing things very often during the pandemic, but they have like medieval fairs where people will be reading the poetry of Giacomo de Lentini. They will be acting out these scenes and to kind of preserve the memory. Mm. There's just so much, you know, whenever I go to Italy, the phrase that always comes to my mind is an embarrassment of riches. Right. There's just so much there. And there are so many castles that as I was looking up, you know, where you would go, because I was trying to imagine an itinerary, like a tourist on an itinerary. I'm going to go on the Frederick II itinerary, and I'm going to go to all these castles. The thing is, so many of these castles are, they're not kept up, which is amazing. I mean, they're 1,000 years old, and they're historically significant. In some cases, they're architecturally significant.
And it's just growing up around it.
Yeah, there's just weeds and garbage. Yeah. You know, you may find that it's, oh, well, it's closed today, even though, you know, supposedly it should be open, which is a shame. I mean, obviously some of the bigger ones and the better preserved ones in cities like Palermo or what are some of the other ones? Actually, the one in Lentini, I think, is in good, or the Castel del Monte in Puglia. Well, they're ones that are kind of on the tourist trail, but there's a lot more. I mean, there are so many. And in some cases, as I said, they're really kind of an outcropping. You know, there's rocks or there's a tower. There's the some of the castles that I'm trying to read the whiteboard that I wrote the names on and say the problem is I left it on the couch.
Our dog ate our homework
over it and he erased some of my writing. So there's the castle of the canon, Cannuni. I don't know the Sicilian, but I think it's called Cannuni. And the reason it's called the castle of the cannons is because it had these towers that look like huge cannons. Mm-hmm. In Augusta in Sicily, there's a castle that's in a square shape. We mentioned the one in Castel del Monte in a different shape. So they're also, you know, they're architecturally interesting, they're historically interesting, and we tried in this episode to also talk about some of the literary significance of this.
But this is one of those episodes that also points to other. We've talked about Petrarch and we've talked about Dante. I mean, our Dante episodes focused on the Divine Comedy, but La Vita Nuova, you know, when you hear the poetry of Dante, frequently those uos, he's adopting that, it seems, from Sicilian. Correct, Anne? Am I the o instead of the uo? So yeah. That's something. And occasionally you'll hear people in spoken Italian do that. They'll say buono instead of buono.
Right.
So it's one of the things. Oh, and I think you had asked me to take a look for the poetry of Giacomo da Lentini, the most recent translation. So I'll just
talk about
it now. Richard Lansing has done a translation.
Yeah.
With an introduction by Akash Kumar, and this is from University of Toronto Press.
I think it's only a couple of years old.
Yeah, so 2018.
Yeah. So if you like love poetry, and who doesn't?
I think Sicily is sort of a hot topic now, though, because again, with trying to keep, you know, if you listen to, I love John McWhorter, and one of the things John McWhorter likes to talk about is the attempt to keep dialects and languages alive, and it's a real challenge. And Sicilian is not in as dire straits as many other languages, but it's a challenge, and it requires vigilance to keep it alive. You know, there's an argument to be made that that Sicilian is really the first Romance language to develop.
After Latin?
Yes. Yes, that it's the earliest Romance language.
Okay.
There are people who've made that argument.
Okay. Yep. Well, and I think certainly its role in the development of Italian literature can't be overemphasized. So I think it's important because I think that everyone's heard of Dante. Most people have heard of Petrarch. I think we talked a little bit about Francis of Assisi and his prayers they also harken back to this troubadour lyric, this tradition of kind of courtly love poetry. But here, Francis didn't write his poems down. I mean, that someone else did, or his prayers, you know, someone else wrote those down for him. These guys were really intending to have a written literary tradition. And that in itself is revolutionary. I think we should mention that Frederick II was also a poet. And he, you know, as I said, that so many of these poets were courtiers or bureaucrats. They had other jobs. So he also had another job. And I'm actually just looking at his dates and I'm thinking, I'm almost the same age Frederick II was when he died. And what have I done? Really, I think a lot comes from this outward looking approach to the world. Rather than turning inward and kind of closing off, it's really an openness to kind of pulling together various traditions and various influences, and ultimately coming up with the groundwork for Italian literature and the Italian language.
Yeah,
I would love to get in a car right now and drive around Sicily, like take 3 months. This is great.
I think we have to get into a plane first.
And go from castle to castle. I think it would be really interesting.
Well, until then.
Until then.
Alla prossima.
Alla prossima. We'll continue with Sicily with Giovanni Verga and Imella Voglia. What is it? How do they translate it? House of the by the Medlar Tree? Yeah. That will be next week.
Ciao.